Greetings, adventurers. It's Guy Hutchinson, and I have a fantastic guest on the line, Ron Wisniewski. How are you tonight?
I'm good, Guy. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Are you at the Goodspeed Opera House area right now? I know you're performing there.
I sure am. We have I'm doing the revival of the musical Something's Afoot right now. We have two more weeks to go.
That's a fantastic place. I mean, that's got to be absolutely beautiful and a fantastic place to perform.
Well, it's one of the great regional theaters in the country, especially for musicals. I mean, I think through the years they've moved over 18 or 19 shows to Broadway. It's where Annie started, where Shenandoah started, where Man of La Mancha started. So it's one of those great places to work.
Wow, absolutely fantastic. Is this your first time working there, or have you been there?
Oh, no. I've this is my seventh or eighth show up here.
Wow.
I'm going to give away my first one was in 1990, so that's mm-hmm. a few years ago.
You've got a tremendous body of work. When did you start, what was the first thing you did? I mean, I see you have plays going back to 1974, but did you do anything before that?
Oh, no. I started, as many people do, simply in a high school play.
Mm-hmm. That's what
know?
I mean,
and,
yes.
And, you know, it was a comedy. People laughed at what I did, and then I was hooked. that's pretty much the story. So I never kind of looked back after that.
You're born in Pittsburgh. Did you go to high school out there?
I went to high school and college. I went to the University of Pittsburgh as well.
So you're out there in Pittsburgh. You're growing up. As a little boy, do you remember what you wanted to be?
You know, that's interesting. My dad was a cement contractor, put in driveways, sidewalks, steps, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a housewife. My dad always said, I don't want you doing this kind of work. I want you to push a pencil.
Okay.
That's what he always said. So grandfathers were coal miners as well. So I grew up in kind of a very working class kind of environment. So when I started to do, I was very politically active when I was young as well.
Oh,
so
really?
I could have taken, there was a fork in the road. You know, we all have those forks in the road in our lives where you go one way or another. And when I was 18, I turned 18 and I was very politically active locally, like helping local politicians and things, even at that age. And I ran for delegate to the Democratic National Convention, which that year was going to be in New York City.
So this is 1976, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there were 43 people on the ballot for six slots, and I came in seventh.
Okay, that's
so
not bad.
So I lost it by about 300 votes. And I always say that had I won that slot as a delegate at the convention, I would have gone to New York at 18 or 19, however old I was. Been a very young delegate. I would have met a lot of people, and my life might have taken a turn that way. But I lost that election, so I went into theater. So there you have it.
What got you interested in politics? Was it your family? Was there a lot of interest in politics around the house, or was it something you stumbled across on your own?
Well, I think my grandfather was my mother's father was a naturalized American citizen, and I watched him every election day put on a suit, his hat. In the morning, he would take the American flag out and hang it up. Someone would come and pick him up. He'd get his cane, and somebody would say, "Where are you going?" They called him Tata. "Where are you going, Tata?" "I go to vote." And it was quite a big deal. So I think that was an example, you know.
Yes.
And then I just always was there. I still am. I still am active in, not like campaigning for people that I believe in, you know, mm-hmm. and helping with their campaigns when I have time. But I mean, certainly nothing as a profession, you know, don't have time for that.
I love that story about your grandfather, though, because that is the kind of thing that sticks with a young person, and you see that and you say, well, this must be very important, you know, and it drives you in one direction. So you were going in that direction, you go in a different direction. Tell me about when you were learning to act, when you were in school and you saw this. What drove you into it? Was it?
Let me just say one more thing about my grandfather.
Sure.
I used to also observe him watching television, and at the time when Nixon was president, mm-hmm. and whenever Nixon would come on the television, he would spit at the television. So that's a whole nother story. Though.
No, that's incredible. I love that.
He would literally spit at the television. And so I don't do that, but I mean, I did watch him do that. Well, anyway, I think what it was, I think that every performer, you don't know about it until it hits you, and then there's nothing else you can do about it if that's what you're meant to do. I mean, there are many, 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 many people who go through high school and college and they do a play or something, you know, and they don't do it again. And then there are those of us who experience it for the first time, and something clicks in your head. This is what I am meant to do. This is what I want to do. Because it's not an easy life, but I mean, it's something that you realize that's what I'm meant to do, not this or not this or not this. This is what I'm meant to do, and I think that's true of pretty much. A lot of the people I work with say the same thing. I mean, there was sort of no choice in there. And believe me, I was discouraged mightily by my parents.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, they didn't understand it at all. And I'm often asked by parents of younger people who, you know, what is show business? Do everything you can to put roadblocks in their way. Don't give them rides to where they need to go. Don't give them any extra money. Mm-hmm. Don't give them lessons. Don't give them anything. And if they find a way to still do it, then they're meant to do it. But there are a lot of, you know, people who just have it, you know, it's their parents are pushing them into it. But I mean, I always say that. I say, you know, if they really want to do it, they'll do it. You don't need to do anything, you know.
Yeah.
Believe me, my parents didn't understand. Of course, if you talk to my mother today, she's 84 now, if you said that I said this, she'd say, I never said that.
So how young were you when you started doing it professionally? I mean, when did you first get a paycheck for it?
Out of college. I mean, right out of college, I got my equity card right out of college, and then I moved to New York right after that, and sort of was pretty lucky right away. You know, I sort of started working right away, and I mean, I was pretty fortunate. However, I must say that, like, when I was in college, I did a lot of shows in college, and when I was in college, you had these marvelous sets and costumes and things in college, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's college, right? And my first professional job was working at a dinner theater in Louisville, Kentucky.
Wow.
A production of Camelot with a total of 12 people in the cast.
Wow.
And I'm not lying to you that the sheriff of this Shelbyville, Kentucky sheriff came and padlocked the theater on New Year's Eve for back taxes. So there was nowhere but up after that. But that was my first professional job. The check's clear.
Yeah. How'd you get out to Kentucky?
Oh, I think I was still in college, And I don't know if they still have these things, but they used to have these theater conference auditions around the country. And I'm pretty sure a bunch of us went to where a lot of theaters come to hire people for their seasons. I don't know if they still do this or not, but I went to that and I got this job. And it was my equity card. I mean, at that point, that was my goal. Was I got to get my equity card before I moved to New York. So, because I didn't want to go through, I knew that was what I wanted to do, so I didn't want to mess around with non-union things and, you know.
Right. Explain exactly what an equity card is for anybody.
Actors Equity Association is the union professional actors, stage actors in the United States.
And how do you get that? How did you get that back then?
You get it by getting a contract. So someone hires you to work. That's still the same. It's still true.
Mm-hmm.
Someone hires you to work at an equity theater, and you sign the equity contract, and then you have to join the union. I think there's another way to get into the union where they have equity membership candidate, where kids get weeks toward getting their equity card. I think they have to work in theaters for like 40 weeks as an apprentice or something, and then they can take a test. Which is, some type of simple test, just, like, what does AFTRA mean, what does SAG mean, that kind of thing. And then they can get their equity card that way, too.
Now, how did you get out to Kentucky? Was this the first trip you had away from your family?
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, actually. When I was in high school, my friend Alfred and I, who's my oldest friend in the world, he's a set designer actually now, and we were kind of theater struck, both of us, and we would save all of our money from our part-time jobs in the summer, and for some, I don't know how they let us do it, but we took two trips to New York City, and we booked like a hotel. We found a hotel, booked a hotel in New York. I think the first time we went, we stayed at the Windsor Hotel, and we were just so green. I mean, we were just kids, But we ordered tickets ahead of time. There was no such thing as the half price booth in Times Square and all that stuff. So we ordered tickets ahead of time. They came in the mail. We ordered the months in advance, so we had front row seats for everything. And I remember the first thing that we both saw on Broadway was Julie Harris in The Belle of Amherst, her one-woman show playing Emily Dickinson. We were front row center, and we were so close. It was just mesmerizing, first of all, just being in New York, and then having Julie Harris standing there, right in front of you. And I remember thinking, I remember being fascinated by looking up at her and seeing the spit flying from her mouth. As her, on stage, diction is everything, and her diction was perfect, and the way you get good diction is you spit. So this spit was like, and my friend Alfred was sitting next to me, and he's like, he kind of leaned over and went, she's spitting on us. I said, let her spit, but that was a great experience. We were brave. We were really, really green, though. I remember also that same trip. We thought we were pulling it off, We thought we were pulling it off, and no one thought we were tourists, I don't know how old we were. Maybe 16, 17, and by ourselves as well. I don't know how we got our parents to agree to it. But I remember that we went to Sardi's. Mm-hmm. And we were nervous wrecks because we'd never been anywhere but a diner before then, And we went to Sardi's, and we had dinner, and we were pretending like we knew what we were doing for the entire dinner. And then we thought we'd pulled it off, and as we were leaving, as we were getting ready to pay the check and leave, the waiter said to us, "Out on the town tonight, boys!" Oh, Jesus, we just were crestfallen because we thought we were very sophisticated, but we weren't.
Wow. So, Kentucky, how was that? I mean, was this a heck of an adventure?
Well, that was an adventure, sure, because it was, well, before we, I mean, as it turned out, it was quite a, you know, I mean, you have to pay your dues in this business, and that job was paying your dues. I mean, we're standing stage right, the dishwasher was there, was a dinner theater, and it would flood, and we were standing in 4 inches of water before we went on. There were 12 people in the cast. I mean, you know, it was quite miserable, but it was an adventure. It sure was. I mean, because this was going there. I remember as a kid thinking, oh, my first professional job. Oh my God. And then of course, after experiencing this place, I remember thinking, gee, I should go to graduate school. Is this what the professional theater is like? Of course it's not. But I mean, you know, when you're starting out, you start at the bottom, you know.
Right. Let me ask you about schooling, because a lot of people don't feel that they would need to get a college degree to act. What was it, your parents that drove you to get it, and are you glad you did?
Oh, very glad I went to college. I think it's a mistake to only study in a conservatory environment where you learn, you know, there are many theater schools where you're going to learn, you know, how to sight read, singing, voice, acting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but nothing else.
Right.
And I think to be a good actor, you need to know a little bit about a lot of things, because you're called upon to play, well, I'm a character actor. I mean, I'm called upon to play many, 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 many different kinds of things, and you need to know a lot about history and sometimes geography, and sometimes, you know, if you're doing a play like Breaking the Code, you need to know about math. You know, I mean, you need to know a little bit about everything. And I think if you're just isolated in that world of, you know, I'm studying voice, I'm doing all that, and you're not in reading great novels and studying English literature and studying world literature and studying all different things, you know, I mean, it all contributes to your craft, I think. So I went to a liberal arts, University of Pittsburgh. I ended up with a triple major when I graduated from undergraduate. I had English lit, English writing, and theater. So I had my foot in the English department as well. But then in the liberal arts school, you know, you have to take other subjects.
Sure,
they used to call it distribution of studies. They used to call it. And so, you know, I mean, you had to take your psychology course, and you had to take your math course, and I think that's important for kids, I really do. Because if you're all just focused on one thing, you're only going to know about that, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
How boring would that be?
When you were in college, you're doing a lot of shows in college. I've always wondered about this. At what point do you start to know which types of roles you want, or at that point are you just taking whatever role you can get? I mean, I assume there's a transition point to it where you're looking for roles you want.
Well, you gotta have an idea of, well, I mean, they're casting you in things in college, so they're pointing you in the direction of what they think you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Then whether you succeed or not at doing it points you further in that direction or in another direction. You know what I mean? It's all been a very experimental kind of thing when you're in college. You don't really know your kids, you know. But I knew that I was a character actor, you know. I knew that. And I loved, you know, old movies on television. I mean, the greatest actor or actress whoever lived, in my opinion, is Bette Davis. And Bette Davis was a character actress, you know, who became a star. But the character actors that I really admire are people like Charles Laughton and Claude Rains and Lionel Barrymore, you know. I mean, that was always what I was gravitating to. I also like to, I still do, I like myself to disappear. You know, I like to be someone else. You know, I like to look different. I like to sound different. I like that. That makes me happy. Especially at theaters that I've worked at a lot. There's no greater compliment to me if I walk on stage and they don't know who I am, even though they do know who I am. And then later they're like, oh my God, that was him, that same guy who played that. Oh, yeah. That's a great compliment, I think.
Right.
So I think that in answer to your question, I got digressed. In answer to your question, I mean that, you know, I do know a lot of people, I have to say this, who have a strange idea of what they're right for. You know, I mean, so, you know, like friends will say, you know, there's an audition for something, and they'll say, well, I'm going in for this. I'm going in for, you know, Lori in Oklahoma, and I'm thinking to myself, I think you're probably going in for Ann Teller. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's fairly rare if you have a successful career, you know. But there are people who have a strange idea of what they're right for, what they look like, you know, what they can do. You also got to know your limitations, too. I'm not going to be singing grand opera, you know what I mean, nor would I even try, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to know what you can do and what you can't do. And I'm not, you know, I could never be, never could be in, like, an ensemble of a show dancing because I can't do that. But, I mean, I can move and dance enough that if I'm down front, I'm fine. But, I mean, I could never do what the ensemble kids do, you know, never could.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you gotta, you certainly, you know, like, all you gotta do is go to one dance call in New York for a Broadway show, and then you'll know you can't do it. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it doesn't take long to learn that.
I'm looking at your biography, your chronology on your website, which, by the way, fantastic website. People should check it out.
Oh, thanks.
Let me spell the name just so everybody has it. RONWISNISKI.com. And I love this where you can see your headshots, you know, from bottom to top or top to bottom.
Watching myself age.
It's really fascinating, though, to see from also.
I have to say, you see that picture, the very youngest one?
Yes.
That was, remember I told you about that trip Alfred and I took to New York?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we also went to have headshots taken on that trip, and we literally walked into some place off of Times Square, and we had our headshots taken, you know, for like, I don't know what it was, $50 or something, you know, some pack place. And when we got them back, we were embarrassed by them. We thought, oh, my God, these are terrible. And we actually just talked about this recently. And he said, and I said, yeah, remember what we thought about them when we got them?
Yeah.
We thought, oh, these are terrible. Oh, we could never use these. Oh, my God. And, of course, now I look at it and I go, that was the most beautiful person in the world.
And these are great, the two of them. You're talking the bottom two here. They're, you know, wonderful, you know, well-lit, well-composed shots.
Well, I mean, you know, at the time, we you know, you think you look different than
at
you
that
do,
age.
I think, when you're a kid.
I
guess
so.
I don't know.
Yeah. But I'm looking here. I see this. I see this credit. 1981, Tokyo. What was this?
Oh. Well, that's an interesting story. When I was in college, I did as my master's thesis project a one-man show playing Teddy Roosevelt called Bully, written by Jerome Alden, which James Whitmore had done on Broadway. And I was the first person to do it, actually. I found it on a bookshelf at a bookstore at school in Pittsburgh, and I thought, oh, this might be interesting, and it sort of merged the two. I had admired Teddy Roosevelt as well, so it sort of merged my two interests, politics and theater. And so I did it. And it was done at college, and then it was such a success there that a local theater in Pittsburgh asked me to do it some more. And so we moved it over there for another couple of months, and then another theater asked me to do it. So it turned like, it became like a thing. And when I moved to New York, that was sort of, you know, what are your credits when you first get out of college? Well, he played Teddy Roosevelt in this one-man show, he did this dinner theater. So it was sort of like, oh, that's the kid that did this one-man show playing Teddy Roosevelt. And a notice went up that a friend of mine saw on one of the, the Equity job bulletin board over at the Equity building. And she called me up and she said, they're looking, Japanese television is looking for somebody to play Teddy Roosevelt in a mini series. And I said, and fat chance I'm going to have of getting that. And she goes, why not? She's like, why not? I said, because I'm 20. You know, it's one thing to do something in college with makeup on. It's another thing to go to New York and do it. It's certainly another thing to do it in a television miniseries, you know. So it's, again, just brave and stupid back then, you know. So I had all the costumes still from the one-man show. And so I had a fat suit that was made for me to make me look heavier to play Teddy Roosevelt. I put all that on. I put all the makeup on, and I went to this audition, and I got the job. I don't know how old they thought I was, but I got the job. Yeah. And it was filmed. My segments were filmed at Sagamore Hill, Teddy Roosevelt's home on Long Island, in the rooms, on his furniture. It was really I was just a kid, and the two stars from Japan, and of course this story was about Teddy Roosevelt mediating the Russo-Japanese War of 1905 or 06, which he won the Nobel Peace Prize for. So this was the story of him mediating between the Japanese and the Russians, this treaty that stopped that war. And so I remember that I thought, oh, now that I've pulled the wool over these people's eyes, they were all Japanese. Mm-hmm. So they had no idea, you know, that I wasn't who I was presenting myself to be, I suppose. And I took my friend Julie with me as my assistant. She was just a friend. Because I thought it would be a good idea. I mean, just stupid kids.
Right.
Because I had to, like, keep this, you know,
this aura,
ruse. Mm-hmm. And I never had been in front of a camera before or anything, so I didn't know what I was facing or anything. I just bluffed my way through it. And the two Japanese actors, who I found out later were fairly famous in Japan, who were there filming these segments at Sagamore Hill, whose names escape me, but they were just very, very, and they spoke only in Japanese, and their stuff was going to be subtitled, and I spoke only in English, and my stuff would be subtitled in Japanese. It was one of those international-type things. And I suppose the Russian people spoke in Russian and, you know, were subtitled in Japanese. And somehow we got our way through it, but I do remember Julie was kind of chesty, big breaths, and it was summer. And I remember that they didn't speak much English, one of the crew members from Japan said to Julie, you have such beautiful breath. And of course she blushed and looked down and everything, and he caught the fact that she was embarrassed. And he said, no, everybody thinks so. But I mean, so then anyway, that kind of was weird, because then one thing led to another, and then I did that, then I got the national tour right away of Tin Types, the musical, where the character is Teddy Roosevelt. Again, so it's very odd because I'm much too tall. I'm 6'3", so I'm much taller than he was. And suddenly I was sort of typecast for a couple of years as Teddy Roosevelt, of all things. But you never know, you know. But that's how I sort of got into the business.
Did you, and you did speeches as Teddy Roosevelt for political fundraisers?
Oh, well, that's when I was out of work. And so, you know, years ago, and a friend of mine said, well, you did the one-man show, and you did this, and you did that. Why don't you make up a brochure? I think it was in an election year. And he said, why don't you make up a brochure and try to sell yourself to, like, political fundraisers and stuff. And I sort of thought, well, it can't hurt. So I mailed this thing to, like, you know, like Republican Party organizations and things. And I started getting bookings from it. And that's an interesting story, too. One of the people that, again, I was just a kid. And I had all these costumes still from the one-man show, so I didn't have to do anything. And I had all this material because I had all his speeches and things, you know, that I already had memorized. And I forget the guy's name. He was running for governor of New York, or I can't remember his name now. I'd have to be home to look it up. He was running for governor. Whitney North Seymour was his name. And he was running for, I believe he was running for governor of New York, and he had all these fundraisers that he wanted me to do. And there was this big fundraiser on Tuxedo Park in New York, which is a very upscale millionaire area, you know,
okay,
up the Hudson River. And again, I took my friend Julie with me, and we went because I needed an assistant, you know. So we went up there, and we were still pretty green, you know. We're riding in a car from the train to wherever this mansion was, somebody's house that was holding this fundraiser, and I was going to perform these monologues in between or something. And we rode it. Somebody else got off the train and rode with us. This very distinguished looking gentleman. We didn't know who he was, and he's like, and we're like, we're talking to him like he's help too, you know, like some of the help, you know. We're like, oh yeah, we're going up to so-and-so's house, we're doing this fundraiser, I'm playing Teddy Roosevelt, this is Julie Pope. We find out later it was Louis Auchincloss.
Now who is that?
The author. Well, Louis Auchincloss is a very famous historian and author and a relative of Jackie Kennedy's.
Oh, wow.
And here we are just carrying on like fools in this van with him. And you know, I think he got a kick out of it, actually.
Right. That's fantastic. That is really interesting. So getting back to when you first did Teddy Roosevelt, one-man show, I never think of that as being something a young actor would do. You know, obviously the work of carrying the whole thing on your own is very hard, but I wonder about the mindset of going to do that at a young age.
I think you're just brave. I mean, if I were facing that today, I would think twice, three times. But I mean, you're just brave and foolish, and you'll try anything. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like anything. I mean, you just try anything. You're just like, oh, I can do that. You have a lot of bravery, and somehow I managed to pull it off. But I mean, oh, now I would think twice, three times before attempting something like that. That's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you always have a knack for memorizing?
For memorizing? Yeah. I've never had any problem with it. I think it's a skill, though. I mean, I always say to people at some of these talkbacks at theaters when the audience asks you questions and they say, they always say, how do you memorize all those? I always say, well, I mean, just think of how many things you have memorized. You know your Social Security number. You know you might know your bank account number. You know telephone numbers. You know, those you've memorized those.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so if you sat down and started memorizing things like we do every day, you know, that part of your brain gets better. And,
right.
you know, I can pick up, I think now after 32 years doing it, I can pick up, you know, 2-3 pages and in 5 minutes have it pretty well memorized, you know. But that's what I do for a living, though. So, I mean, I can't rebuild a carburetor,
right.
and other people can do that. So,
is it?
I think it's just a skill.
Is it harder to go back and do a role you've done before? Do you? I mean, is it? Do you have to relearn the whole thing if it's been a few years?
Oh no, not at all. I've done many things more than once, and
right.
Even if 10 years, even if 15 years have passed, it's very strange. I find that it's in there somewhere, and that if I pick up that script again, having not looked at it for 10 years, a role I played before, it comes back to me much more quickly because I had memorized it once before. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Yeah, I mean, you never kind of lose it. I could do, if I had a cue line for something from, that's 30-some years ago, and I haven't looked at it since, from that Teddy Roosevelt show, mm-hmm. I could probably give you a few lines for that, if I had like a cue line from it. You know what I mean?
Interesting, yeah.
Because it's all in your head somewhere. Especially shows that I've done over and over again. They never leave. You know, I mean, you can pick it up immediately and look at it. One day you're back with all the words, you know. So it's interesting. But when you learn something that thoroughly, I guess, it stays with you, you know. And I've heard that from other actors, too. Because I do a lot of things over and over again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I call them my annuity roles, you know.
Which of those do you like going back to the most? I see you do. You have done FDR and Annie a whole lot.
Yeah, I do enjoy that. And I haven't done that for a few years, but I pretty much like whatever I'm doing at the time. I have things if they want me to do it again, I'm happy to do it again because I enjoy doing it, like Applegate and Damn Yankees or Lumiere and Beauty and the Beast or Pelennor and Camelot or things I've done over and over, Thénardier and Les Mis, things like that. I mean, I enjoyed doing them the first time, and I'm sure I'd enjoy doing them the second time, third time, fourth time, you know. And the fact is it's all different production with different people, so it's different, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really the same. You're playing the same role, but you can't and you shouldn't give the same performance that you gave when you did it with a different director and with different actors and everything, because then you're not really doing your job. You really got to press the erase button on what you did before and do it again, do it new.
Interesting.
You know?
I noticed you have a handful of TV credits when you were out there in New York in the 80s, a lot of a couple soap operas here and there. Did you like working in TV?
Yeah, not at all.
Interesting.
Not at all.
Why not? What was the difference that you felt? Is it the audience?
The audience, yeah. Having an audience. And I also like going to work every day. I really do. I like doing 8 shows a week. I like going to work every day. Yeah, definitely. I like being on stage. It's just boring to me. I mean, it's just boring. A lot of waiting around, doing nothing. You know, it doesn't appeal to me. Now the money appeals to me, but the work doesn't appeal to me. There's nothing like a live audience. There just is nothing like it. And people don't realize when they go to the theater that they're so used to watching films and television. I don't think they realize that we are as aware of them as they are of us, especially in a comedy. And if they're having a good time, they're going to see a better show because it makes your adrenaline pump more, you know. they really are a character in the play when you're working on stage, the audience. And they're different every night. Because people say, oh, how do you keep doing this over and over and over again? Like, I've been up here 3 months during this show. And I say, well, you know, the audience is different every night. So the show's different. And it's live, you know. So, and you feel different every day when you get up and, you know. So it's not different that you would see. That you can't do. You have to do the same thing every night. It's different in how it's perceived and reacted to. That's what I mean. I'm not advocating for undisciplined performing. You have to do the same show every night.
You've done a lot of national tours. How is that? I mean, that must be amazing. And you must get a totally different reaction from town to town.
I would say not from town to town. I would say from night to night. I don't think it has anything to do with geography. I think it just has to do with who's in that building on a particular night together in the same room. Yeah. No, I don't think it has anything to do with, like, where you're playing.
Interesting.
I think it has to do with the individuals who gather that night to watch something together, you know, in the theater, you know. Because there are quiet audiences and there are crazy loud audiences, and you know, and it doesn't mean they're not enjoying it any the less. It just means that, I don't know who said, I think Carol Channing said that Thursday nights were the best nights for some reason. And there's something written about that, like Tuesday night. I think maybe, was it Noel Coward said, oh, Tuesday night, there was some of that. You have to look that up. I can't remember. I don't want to quote it wrong.
Interesting. Let me look it up. Noel Coward. Tuesday nights. I'll see if I can find his quote.
Tuesday night. Or like performance nights. Or
I don't see it. No, I don't. I don't see it. I'm not looking. I must not be looking the right search term. Tuesday night performance.
I'm going to try.
Let me see here.
Noel Coward.
You Googling it?
I don't know if it's coming up.
Yeah. Maybe it wasn't Tuesday.
Well, I mean, he went through the whole week when he was talking about
it. Oh,
wow. And named each night and said, well, on Saturday night they're drunk and this night they're, you know, and I don't know what night he thought was best. But I do remember hearing Carol Channing always say, oh, it's Thursday. You know, she enjoyed playing on Thursday nights.
What night do you enjoy? Do you sense a difference like that?
Oh, yeah, there is a difference. There definitely is. Like, Saturday nights are probably the worst, because I think people, they've had a big dinner, they're a little loaded, they don't have to get up the next day. Friday nights are good because they just, you know, can be good because they just came off work, you know, and they're looking forward to their weekend. Matinees can be really great, because these are people coming to matinees, especially during the week, who are, you know, usually older people, and they're out to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole purpose of getting on that bus or whatever they're coming to the theater in together, you know, those groups, is they want to have a good time. You know, so I think I'd say probably Friday nights are the best. But again, I think it depends.
Right.
You could go out on a Tuesday and go, "Wow, that was a great audience." I just think it's who all those people coming into one place, none of them know each other, and somehow they develop their own personality in the audience. They form a personality. It's interesting. But you'd have to be on the other side of the footlights to see what I mean.
Right. How quickly do you feel that? How early in the show can you tell how this crowd's going to be? Is it before the curtain goes up?
Well, I think probably, you know, like within a few if you hear before the curtain goes up, a lot of chatter and, you know, that can be an indication that they're all happy out there before it even starts. So I think for a comedy, though, the way you know is because if you've been running a show for a while, you know where the laughs are. right. where you know where you usually get them. So you could tell almost immediately when you hit that first joke or that first laugh whether they're with you or not. And then sometimes it just takes them a while to warm up and they get fine later. So you never know. Like I said, they're different every time. Right. People don't realize that they have, we talk about them all the time too. Oh my God, you see that woman in the front row fell asleep during this? Yeah, I mean, we talk about them all the time.
What's worse, a dead crowd or a rowdy crowd?
Oh, dead. Oh,
really?
Dead is the worst. Yeah. Oh, if they're silent. Good God. Especially if you're playing comedy. Good God. Who wants that? Oh, no. Rowdy's much better.
Have you ever dealt with a really rowdy crowd?
Oh, well, you mean like big laughs?
Well, no,
yeah.
I mean, you know, a crowd where they're heckling, where they're, you know, unhappy.
No.
Good.
No.
I've heard.
No. I think that's more stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
But
not in the theater.
I've heard stories of drunks in the crowd and things like that. And
well, know. There is a great story actually about that. In the theater, nobody boos anymore, you know. They politely applaud no matter how awful the garbage is.
Sure.
Out there. You know what I mean? Yeah, they polite, you know, they're polite. I think when you pay $100 or more a ticket, you want to believe that what you just shelled out that money for is pretty damn good. You know what I mean? I
mm-hmm.
think that's the logic. But, I mean, there's a great story about... people used to boo and throw things and everything in the theater, you know, in the, you know, 19th century. And, you know, if they didn't like something, man, you knew it. And there's a great story about this actor manager in England. And he was doing, Shakespeare in repertory, his company, traveling around. And he would give a curtain speech every night, and he came out to give the curtain speech. He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. Next week, I will be assaying the role of Hamlet, and my lady wife will be playing Ophelia." And from the back of the house, somebody yells, "Your wife's an old rat bag!" And he says, "Nevertheless, nevertheless, she will..." Yeah, so I mean, there was a lot of heckling that went on in the old days, but not anymore, not really.
That is fantastic. So something's afoot. Right now, you're performing this at the Goodspeed Opera House. When is the next performance?
Tomorrow, matinee. We have two more weeks through December 9th, and then I have a couple weeks off, and then I start rehearsal for... Funny Girl at Riverside Theater in Vero Beach, Florida, and that runs through the end of January. And then there are two other things I haven't signed contracts for yet, so I can't talk about them.
Oh, big secrets. Well, we'll look for them. What do you do on your time off? What do you do when you get those weeks off?
Oh, it's so nice to be home, you know. It's just nice to be home. Well, you have to keep auditioning, you know, so... it's not as busy as when you're working, but, I mean, you are going out and auditioning for things down the road, months ahead, you know.
Yeah, how does that work? I mean, are people always, are shows always cast way in advance?
Yeah, like, for example, for the summer work, which I'm talking June, July, August, those auditions will be happening in New York, at the beginning of February.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, it's way ahead. Yeah, I got this job didn't start till September 11th. We started rehearsal, I believe, and I did the audition and was offered it at the end of May. So it's several months ahead. Yeah, It's nothing like opera where they book you years ahead, but it's months ahead, you know.
Yeah, and do you get a rapport with the area? I mean, when you're in an area that long, you must have a favorite restaurant, you know, a dry cleaner's.
Oh, sure. Well, like, for example, I've been coming up here. I mean, this is my seventh or eighth show up here, so I know everybody at the theater. I know people in the towns. I know audience. You know, I mean, I know a lot of people up there. Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, Sacramento, I've been going there for 8 years every summer. You know, certainly know your way around, for
right.
sure, yeah.
And the show, people could still go, or is it all sold out?
Oh, no, I think their tickets are still available for this. Runs two more weeks. I mean, I'm not sure about specific dates, but I'm sure you
right.
get something.
And tell everybody a little bit about it and a little bit about the part of Clive.
Oh, well, this is a spoof of Agatha Christie mysteries, or mysteries in general, a musical, that was originally done in the 70s, and this is his first major revival since then. You know, it's what you would expect, you know, a house full of suspects with a murder, you know, sort of like 10 Little Indians, if you mm-hmm. know that Agatha Christie play. It is spoof to take off on that, just goofy, silly fun.
That's great. When you look at parts, was there a part that you always wanted that you eventually got, or is the dream part still out there?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, just a couple years ago, I was offered Fagin in Oliver, and I had always wanted, I had coveted that role for years. And that's not a musical that's done that often. And I wanted it very badly, and I got it. And I just had a blast doing it, because I'd always wanted to do it. And I finally got to do that. Yeah, it was a wonderful thrill. There aren't many of those left, you know what I mean? I've done most of the ones I wanted to do. But there are always new things coming that you go, ooh, what about that? You know what I mean? So as far as the classic ones, you know, and as I get older, I get into another age range as well, which opens up different kinds of roles, you know what I mean? So, but that one particularly, I was so thrilled to have a chance to do it, because I always wanted to do it.
Yeah. Is it one you knew the words by heart before you started?
No, I'm not that crazy. No, they got to start paying me before I start learning it.
Oh, man. Well, it is absolutely a blast talking to you. I really appreciate you taking so much time to tell us all about your craft. You've got an amazing career, and people can find out about it on your website, and they can find out where they're going to see you on the upcoming shows, which we don't know about yet, which is very exciting to look forward to.
Absolutely.
Ron was
well, thanks, guys.
Thank you so very much.
All right, you take good care.
And thank you to you for listening, and we'll see you next time.